I'm Doug Nadvornik. It's February 18th, 2019. Welcome to the first Inland Journal podcast from Spokane Public Radio. For nearly 2 years, Inland Journal has been SPR's weekly public affairs program on the radio, and now we're experimenting by expanding it to a daily podcast. Today, men and the reaction to the Me Too movement, and a history lesson about President's Day. The heavy lifting in the public debate about domestic violence is often done by women and organizations such as the Young Women's Christian Association, the YWCA. That has to change, says Jackson Katz. He's an author, filmmaker, and activist. He created a gender violence prevention and education program entitled Mentors in Violence Prevention. He speaks around the nation, including last week in Spokane. Katz says the hashtag MeToo movement spawned a Twitter campaign called hashtag HowIWillChange. He says researchers have looked at that campaign and discovered the men who participated in it fall into three categories.
The first one was men who embraced the need for men to change and to be more engaged as allies to women in working against sexual harassment, sexual assault, domestic violence. Men who understood their responsibility to the next generation, to be mentors to younger men, and to change sort of the culture of, you know, abusive behavior and gender, sort of the problems that so many men have in terms of the way that they understand what it means to be a man. That was the first category. The second category was men who said, this is a problem, sexual harassment and assault and domestic violence are problems, but they're not my problems. Why should I have to change? Because it's not really my problem. And I resent the fact that you're implying that I'm part of the problem when I don't hurt women and it's not my issue. And that's the kind of not all men response. That was the second category. And the third category was men who were openly hostile to men who would even think about responding positively to a how I will change hashtag. And they were calling men who were saying that they were going to try to do better, they were calling those men, you know, soft and wimps and worse, you know, worse names. And those men often were also explicitly anti-woman, making comments about women that were very degrading and abusive and misogynistic. And so those are the three major categories of response. And I often say in my talks that we need to increase the first category, which is men who say, okay, there's obviously problems here, and how can I be part of the solution? How can I work with women? How can I work with men? How can I, you know, really be part of the solution to these extremely deep and longstanding problems in our species, not just in our society? And the second category, I think, of men who say it's a problem, but it's not my problem, I think there's a lot of potential with that category, because these men aren't in complete denial. They're not openly hostile. They have some growth in front of them, but they are potentially movable into the first category. And so I think a big part of our activism needs to be, how do we figure out how do we get more men into the first category? How do we move more men from the second category into the first? At the moment, I don't think we need to spend our time with the men who are openly, aggressively hostile to all of this. I think there's enough men who are just floating out there, who are good men generally, who don't really understand how they could play a constructive role. I think there is a really great opportunity there.
And what do you think are the messages that are most going to get men from that second category to that first?
There's so many different ways of going about that. One of it, it's personal, because it's personal. So many men have women in their lives who have been assaulted and harassed and abused by other men. There's lots of men who have close, intimate relationships with women who are trauma survivors from their past or even their present. And those men support those women, perhaps, but they haven't thought about how they can be constructive in their workplace, with their groups of friends and their peer cultures, and doing something more than just supporting an individual woman. I think it's good to support individual women, but there's more that they could be doing. So making it personal for, I think, some men is one of the ways in. I think a lot of men respond positively to the notion that we are responsible, those of us who are adults, we are responsible to young people and kids. Some of us are parents, but you don't have to be a parent to be responsible to kids. And there's all kinds of men who are teachers and camp counselors and youth workers and religious, you know, leaders and uncles and older brothers. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that men and young men play roles in young boys' lives and young men's lives. And I think if we say, look, it's our responsibility to help guide them in a complex world where gender norms and sexual norms are changing. And there's new standards that are being applied, and you know, the media culture is filled with all kinds of mixed messages about what it means to be a man, what it means to be a strong man. The political culture is filled with mixed messages. I mean, we have to help guide them. And if we just decide, you know, we're just going to get take our hands off and back away, and we're allowing these other forces to kind of shape their notions of what it means to be a good man or a good person. And do you really want to do that? I think a lot of men can respond like they have a responsibility to younger men. And it's also just the right thing to do. I mean, violence and abuse and harassment is wrong. And if you're a person you have a basic human sort of compassion in your soul and your psyche, you see injustice, you see abuse, and you're in a position to do something about it, do something, you know? And what about fairness? I talk about fairness. A lot of men, including myself, respond very positively to the notion of fairness. It's just right. The right thing to do is to treat people with respect and dignity and challenge other people who are not treating others with respect and dignity. And if you're a man and you see other men around you who are not treating women with respect and dignity, it's wrong and it's unfair. And do you believe in fairness? Do you believe in justice? And do you believe that people should be treated with dignity? And if you do, and you see people treating others with indignity and injustice, then what can you do about it? And I don't mean being, you know, heroic. I mean, like, you know, rescuer. It's not some superhero thing. It's just like, how do you, as a person of integrity, not walk away and not put your head down when you see things around you that are going, you know, going wrong? And I think an awful lot of good men, a lot of men who are good people, kind of have taken a back seat on these matters and have kind of like looked aside and looked down and said, like, you know, I don't like this. I don't like the way these people are acting, but it's just like, it's too messy and it's awkward and it's difficult interpersonally, and I'm just going to kind of do my own thing. And what do we have as a result? We have every single day, virtually, you look at the newspapers, you look at the news, it's like one dysfunctional man after another, one dysfunctional system dominated by men after another, being revealed to have patterns of abuse. And the most recent one I referenced in when I talked this morning was the Catholic Church, the Pope himself acknowledging that male priests sexually assaulting nuns is a problem in the Catholic Church. Are you kidding me? This is now a moment in history, I mean, that we're talking about stuff like this that's unprecedented. And men can react defensively and say, it's not all men, it's not me, it's not my responsibility. Or they can say, you know what? I have an opportunity here to be part of some really constructive change. These women have been leading the way, and I'm going to, take up their challenge and the challenge that they're presenting to men, which is you can do better and you need to go out there and work with men and young men and do better. And I think that that's a positive and constructive response. And by the way, that's not at all weak or soft. That's actually strong. And I reject completely the idea that men who speak out about men's violence or men's towards women or men's sexism are somehow soft or weak. That's it's the opposite of the truth. Because I often say, if you're a guy, being one of the guys takes nothing special. What takes something special as a guy is when your guys are acting inappropriately or abusively, is turning to them and saying, this is not cool, the way you're acting. That takes so much more strength. And yet they often turn to you and say, what are you going soft? When in fact, you're actually stronger, because it takes more courage and strength and self-confidence to say that than it does to just go along with the group. And there's an awful lot of men who think that they're strong who just go along with the group.
So are there a bunch of folks here who are sitting down with you, they want to take your message, they want to make it, you know, local here. How do you advise people to take that ground root, that grassroots message, and get it to percolate through a community?
Well, you need stakeholders and partners. You need people who are invested in and who have some influence, so some social capital, some institutional power, sometimes financial power. In other words, business leaders and organizations, leaders and, you know, executive directors of agencies. You got to bring people around the table who have some influence within their spheres, and then figure out ways that they can work together. And I think Spokane has a number of people in this room today, this morning, but also last night where I spoke at Gonzaga. It was a community event hosted at Gonzaga. There's an awful lot of people in this community, including powerful men, who said that they were wanting to think about how they could go the next step. And so the first step is to sit them down around a table, talk to women like the women who run the YWCA, who have been at the leadership, who are leaders in the community and have been at the forefront of this kind of work, and then figure out, okay, how can we work together? How can we collaborate? There's so much potential. And one of the most, I think, inspiring and hopeful aspects of some of the potential collaboration in this community is people are responsive to the idea that domestic violence and sexual assault are connected to child abuse, they're connected to gang violence, they're connected to HIV, transmission of HIV, they're connected to alcohol and drug problems, mental health problems. In other words, the trauma that, for example, the children, I talk a lot about domestic violence effects on children, the trauma that boys, not just girls, but boys suffer, and the relationship between boys who have been traumatized in their families of origin, and then they go out and start acting antisocially, in part in response to the trauma that they've experienced. If you have people around the table who are representing child abuse agencies and youth serving agencies and sports organizations who are trying to develop healthy, boys and girls, and you have business leaders who have, some financial capital, or they have some workplace authority. In other words, they can make things happen within their sphere. You have some political leaders who are in city government and in county government who have their own influence and domains. If everybody's working together, then there's all kinds of potential. But the missing piece, honestly, has been men who are willing to really talk and embrace this. There's been women who have been pushing this, rock up the hill for like the last 40 years. What's really encouraging and new is that there's an awful lot of men now who maybe 10 years ago weren't going to be around that table, and now they are, and that's good.
That's gender violence activist Jackson Katz speaking last week in Spokane. The group of men to whom he's referring calls itself Good Guys. It has an affiliation with the YWCA in Spokane, and it has some high-powered community leaders on its board of directors. Good Guys started as a group of men who attended the Y's annual Women of Achievement Lunch, filling tables, writing checks, supporting women. Doug Kelly from Avista is one of its co-founders.
The first way I got involved with Good Guys was that my wife supports the programs of the YWCA, and she works for Allstate. Allstate has a domestic violence program they support nationally called the Purple Purse. Purple is the color of domestic violence, and they provide, and I'm sorry I can't tell you the name because I don't know fashion, but it's a fashion name, purse, that agents can apply for to utilize to recognize a significant individual in the community for their work in domestic violence. And she invited me to come to this event where she was presenting this for the YW so that I could take some pictures for her.
Jackson Katz talks about men being in three separate areas. There are the men who have really embraced the whole idea of, yes, Me Too, that sort of thing. There are men sort of in the middle who say, yeah, I buy into it, but, and then third are the people who just don't buy into it at all. Where are you, and what's going to get you to that next step?
Well, I'm clearly on my own personal journey as I get more exposed and learn more. I always viewed domestic violence as that final physical act. And once I saw this power and control, well, no, it's all these other things that come into play about controlling friends, about controlling finances, all about that issue of power and control. And it just created a huge aha for me, how ignorant, really, I was to the greater issue. But I would certainly hope, believe that I am out near the front of the, we are not only working with you, we're not only behind you, but in some cases, maybe I even want to be a step ahead, certainly in how we get more men involved with this. But I would say I was easily the second prior. Shoot, I write a check. It's not me, but shoot, I'll write a check to support you. But that's not me. I don't do that. So I believe I'm on that journey to make that shift. I still have growth and learning to do, but I'm becoming more and more passionate, especially as I hear some of the stories locally. A couple of years ago, the YW had a local woman who had a horrific, violent attack by a baseball bat. And her story is absolutely incredible. And you listen to that, and you just can't help but be inspired and say, there are things I can do, I need to do.
Well, from what I got in talking to Jackson, it became clear that he thought that men are the ones that are going to get men to totally internalize this message. It's not going to be, you just talked about a horrific experience from a woman, and we all have that idea, you know, it's awful. But to internalize it and then to make the next step to being an advocate, what are the arguments you think are going to work for men in that case?
Boy, I think it is such a personal, one-on-one kind of conversation. You can expose people to some of the issues, some of the actions, the Jackson Cats, but it's still that one-on-one dialogue, and that's why we need more good guys. We need more people to be exposed to it in order to really then have that dialogue. And in a lot of cases, I don't think it's that big a step, but there needs to be the ask. And if there isn't the ask and it's done based on relationship, then I don't think we get there.
So you got guys to go to the Jackson Cats thing. Well, what's the next step then to get them to continue on that journey?
That's a very good question. We just started an email dialogue today about what do we do next. And the first thing that Manny Hockheimer with New America, who's my co-chair, and I need to do is sit down and get back in touch with those people that were on our advisory board, as well as those that were at the events that said, I'd like to know more about you guys. And we need to solidify who our action people are. And then from there, collectively, we will say, you know, there's a lot of tentacles to this. We can't take it all on. So let's find one or two achievable things as we start to move forward. But there's also an element of we simply need to devise our own mission statement and really identify who we are also. So there's a lot of work going into this. Originally, when I started this, quite honestly, I was pretty happy just getting 100 guys to come to the lunch. And now this has really grown, and I've got to grow to go with it.
So where do you see it being in 5 years? What would it, you know, Bloomsday grew from one race to this giant colossus. Where would you like to see this go?
You may not know my background, but I was the co-chair of the first Bloomsday. And so Don Cardong and I put together the first Bloomsday. I ended up being Bloomsday's first race director. And I had a real passion about is I also volunteered for the YMCA to teach people how to run, to finish a Bloomsday. And I took one of the very, very slowest running groups, and every single person in my running group was a woman who was mid-40s to older. And they grew up in that era when women didn't compete, didn't sweat, didn't do. And so I just got a passion around watching the development, the self-confidence, and the accomplishment of these women as they went through their personal journey and became running animals. And some of them ended up doing full marathons. And so there was a passion around the health, but also about just the personal pride and growth for what we could start to try to do with this issue. This issue has been identified as our number one public health issue for the region. So this gives us something to tie a banner to. But the YW and men, the good guys, are not the only people in this space. So we're really looking to create more of an umbrella organization that's along the lines of end the violence, but that all of us can step under that umbrella and use that to create a program that will have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Hopefully people stay passionate, they stay involved over the course of time, but at least this gives us something to all come together under, and rather than standing out individually, say, no, we're all working towards this issue and come under this and join us.
So how does your wife, as she watches you go through this journey, what does she think about all this?
I hope she's proud of the work we're doing. She is a strong supporter of the YW, not only through her business with Allstate and what they do, but she has personal passion around the issue too. And so I think we're a great team around that. I'm just taking a little different direction.
That's Doug Kelly, who works at Avista for his day job. He's the co-founder of the Good Guys Group, advocating for women on the domestic violence issue. Today is President's Day. It says so on two of the calendars in my office. Technically, President's Day is not the name of the federal holiday. So why do we call it President's Day? I thought it was a combination holiday commemorating the birth of Abraham Lincoln on February 12th and the birth of George Washington on February 22nd. I called Scott Bomboy. He's the editor-in-chief of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. He's written about this.
The way it works is, there's the federal holiday, which is actually Washington's birthday, and that's for federal employees. So it'll be federal employees and subcontractors and people like that. And states actually determine, you know, when their workers have holidays, and a lot of times, you know, local government and county government will follow the state lead. So if you're in Washington state, according to my chart here, it's a single possessive. So it'd be President's, you know, hyphen S day would be the holiday. But there's no standard across the country. So for the federal holiday, it's Washington's birthday. There are 12 states that have President's Day as a single possessive, 10 President's Day as a plural possessive. Four states just have President's Day with no possessive, and 13 states don't even observe President's Day or Washington's birthday.
So why do we call
it? It's kind of a whole mishmash of stuff.
Why do we call it President's Day then?
Well, I think the idea was back in the 1870s, really was the origination of Washington's birthday as an official holiday. And a lot of states, you know, observe Washington's birthday. But in 1968, there was an act of Congress which really consolidated four different holidays into holidays that were really to be observed on Mondays. And that was basically for business reasons. And that's when Washington's birthday became an official national holiday that was observed on Monday. There's actually four different holidays that were Washington's birthday, Memorial Day, Veterans Day, and Columbus Day, reported in June 1968 when they passed the act. And the controversy there was there were a lot of people who were opposed to Veterans Day from November 11th to I believe, the last Monday of the prior month. And that was really controversial. And after, I think, 3 or 4 years, the House and Senate actually moved it back to the original Armistice Day.
And then we don't celebrate Columbus Day either, or some people do and some people don't.
It's a federal holiday. I don't think that many states actually celebrate Columbus Day.
Most states celebrate
some form of President's Day or Washington's birthday.
So I guess your advice would be check what your state is before deciding whether to stay home from work or not.
I wouldn't. I know in Pennsylvania, you know, depending on the county workers are not state workers, obviously, so the county may or may not observe President's Day or Washington's Day. I know when I was doing my research about Ohio, I found some counties in Ohio that did not observe President's Day at all, but the state observed it. So it really depends who your employer is, if you're a government worker. I think it's interesting that there are some states that celebrate President's Day or Washington's birthday in a unique way. For example, Alabama, their holiday is the birthday of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, they don't have a Lincoln's birthday celebration in Alabama. They just don't do that.
What day is Jefferson's birthday?
I don't know what it is. They celebrate it on the same day as Washington's birthday.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
So they do a joint president. They don't call it President's Day. They call it Washington and Jefferson Day. Yeah, and then Utah, they call it Washington and Lincoln Day. So they're covering two bases there. And in Virginia, it's just George Washington Day. It's not his birthday. It's George Washington Day. So states are, you know, they have different unique ways of celebrating holidays.
That's Scott Bomboy from the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And by the way, Thomas Jefferson's birthday is April 13th. Thank you for joining us for the first podcast edition of Inland Journal, Spokane Public Radio's public affairs program. On tomorrow's podcast, we'll talk with Patrick Dineen. He's the author of the book, Why Liberalism Failed. To find and subscribe to the Inland Journal podcast, search for Inland Journal in iTunes, on NPR One, or Google Play, or find it on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Tell us what you think of the program by sending your comments to Inland Journal, that's one form, inlandjournal@kpbx.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.